Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on The Kids Are All Right, the new film by Lisa Charlatanco. And joining me from the Slate office in Washington, D.C. is Dan Coyce. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Dana.
Who is a sometime critic for Village Voice, Washington Post, True Slant. Where else are you writing for these days, Dan?
Honestly, whoever will pay me money.
Yeah, you're just out there on the street corner waving a pen and paper.
I'm a writing mercenary out for hire to the highest bidder.
Well, today we've got you, which is very, very nice. And we actually convoked this emergency spoiler. We weren't going to spoil this movie. I didn't even know if you'd seen it, but we both liked it so much and we're so sure that it's going to be a runaway sleeper summer hit that we decided that we must spoil. So to the studio. So take it away. Do you want to do some plot summary and we'll get into the spoilage?
Sure. The Kids Are All Right is the third film from Lisa Charlatanco, who previously directed High Art and Laurel Canyon. And it's the story of a family, of a not really all that uncommon family, although I think obviously to some minds there might be things that are weird about it. But it's a pair of lesbian parents, longtime partners, played by Julianne Moore and Annette Bening, and their two children who were conceived via sperm donor. One born to one mother, one born to the other. And they're now teenagers. One's just their older daughter, played by Mia Wasikowska. Is that how you pronounce her name?
Wasikowska, I think. I think you're having an extra K in there. I think it's Wasikowska.
Played by Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
Has just graduated from high school, and their younger son is in high school. Together, their two children hatch a plan without the mom's knowledge. To find the sperm donor who provided, who was both of theirs father.
Which is extremely easy in this movie. I would be curious with stories of people who've done this in real life if most people had it that easy. They make it look like they basically just called the sperm bank and got the number and called the guy.
I feel like as long as you go through a reputable sperm donor, which the lifestyle of their two momses suggests they certainly would have done. I don't know that there's any reason it should be so hard. I mean, as long as you're 18, as the daughter is, and as long as the donor did not sign any paperwork saying I absolutely do not want my name revealed under any circumstances, I think it maybe could be that easy. So they find him, and he's sort of a Lothario hippie man of the land / restaurant owner in LA where this movie is set, who played by Mark Ruffalo. As you note in your review wonderfully, he's just Ruffaloing around in this movie.
That's right. If you like your Ruffalo, there's just a hearty dose of classic Ruffalo in this movie.
Right. It's like a Ruffalo stampede.
that was poor, very poor.
Thank you. And he in the beginning is delighted to meet his new children. I mean, sort of weirded out, and it's clear that the possible consequences of sperm donation never really dawned on him. But he's happy to meet them and happy to bond with them. But of course, the introduction of Mark Ruffalo into this very comfortable, if sometimes tense, nuclear family introduces a foreign element that makes everything go a little bit haywire. And the movie is the story of what happens when everyone suddenly has this new thing coming into their life just at this moment of the family being on the cusp of change.
And so, right. So up to there, that's what we could actually say in a review, right? So things start to change when he enters into the family. But since this is a spoiler and not a review, and by the way, let's throw in our spoiler warning here. Don't listen any further if you don't want to hear what happens in the movie, because that's what we're about. So one of the complications that occurs is that Julianne Moore's character, Jules, who's sort of an aspiring landscape gardener, although she hasn't really gotten it together to start her business yet. Go ahead.
Yeah, she seems to be an aspiring landscape gardener, but really actually kind of an accomplished fuck-up.
Right, yeah. And that's gotten across, I think, really, really well and really subtly in the movie. I mean, there's not any moment where, you know, we see a flashback of her last 20 years raising these kids or whatever. But you sort of get the sense that she's been, you know, she's sort of trying to start this business because the kids are growing up and starting to move out of the house. Her partner, Annette Bening, is the successful doctor. I think she's supposed to be an OBGYN based on the little glimpse that you get of her job. And you see that she's sort of, you know, she's the breadwinner and the one who's got it together, and that she sort of lords that over her partner a little bit, too. So Julianne Moore has this aspiring landscape design business, and she agrees to landscape Mark Ruffalo's yard, which Nick, the Annette Bening character, is not happy about at all. And in the process of landscaping his yard, she begins this affair, completely unexpectedly to me. I hadn't seen any previews or anything that, you know, she suddenly starts this straight affair with this somewhat younger man.
Right. And you know, part of the dynamic between the two, between Nick and Jules, has been from the beginning that Nick is a lot more suspicious of the father's reentry into their kid's life. Jules has been a little bit more welcoming from the beginning, partially because she does seem a little bit at sea, and the opportunity that he presents her to work on her garden, though she's a little nervous about it, is an opportunity that she certainly feels she needs to sort of make something out of this new stage of her life. And so it's a betrayal in a couple of ways. I mean, when she begins sleeping with him, obviously it's a betrayal of their marriage, I mean, of their relationship, but also it's a betrayal in that she's cementing a relationship with this guy Paul, that Nick already doesn't trust and already feels concerned about his entry into that family unit. And so in a number of wonderful twists that the movie takes, there's after this affair has been going on for a little while and Jules and Paul don't really know exactly what to do with it, and Paul's really starting to fall for her. There's a dinner, a celebratory dinner, in which Nick really attempts to make her peace with Paul. And in fact, they bond during this dinner over their love of Joni Mitchell, which leads to really a truly wonderful scene. And I guess I would have to say probably the centerpiece of the movie, which is Annette Bening as Nick singing. What song is it?
It's All I Want. It's the first song off the album Blue.
Mm-hmm.
Which he finds in his record collection, and they start talking about it.
Right, and they bond over Joni and how much they love Joni, and it's clear that...
and they've named their daughter after Joni Mitchell, right?
Right. Mia Wasikowska's character is named Joni. And so Annette, in the middle of a sort of wine-soaked dinner, just starts singing Joni, and as you note in your review, it starts out as embarrassing and then becomes sort of transporting as her children see a sort of a glimpse of the younger woman who one of their moms once was. And as we see, because we know that this situation cannot remain as it is forever, we see maybe the last glimpse of her before she realizes the betrayal that her partner has put her through.
Yeah, that's a really, really masterful scene in so many ways, the a cappella Joni Mitchell singing scene, because it starts off and you think you know what kind of scene it is. I mean, I can't think of any other examples right now, but there's plenty of movies in which a tipsy person busts into an a cappella rendition of something and embarrasses a social occasion with it, right? Can you think of any off cuff? I can't really think of any.
I mean, I assume that basically every movie that Will Ferrell's ever been in.
Right, that's true. It's usually a guy, right? It's usually a guy, for one thing. So you think that what the scene is going to be about is sort of, oh no, she's embarrassing herself, and how is she going to be saved from embarrassing herself? But then she kind of keeps going through it, and you see actually the strength of her character and the fact that she sort of knows she's embarrassing herself and doesn't care, and it's the first time she's reaching out to this guy, you know, the father of her children that she's been cutting off this whole time, and the two of them bond through this song. But then it goes on a little bit too long and it starts to be uncomfortable again. It's just really terrifically handled by both the director and by Annette Bening, who I think in a movie that's uniformly strong cast, I think Annette Bening is the standout. Would you agree?
I would also. I mean, everyone in this cast is really pretty fantastic. But yes, this is the kind of performance. I mean, Annette Bening isn't in that many movies anymore anyways, but certainly this is the kind of performance that you've known all along she had in her, and it's earthy and really funny and really very heartfelt. And she's the center of this family. Obviously, I mean, she's the breadwinner of the family, and she's sort of the brittle heart of it. And one of the things I really loved about her performance and about that scene is the way it serves as a microcosm for what is right and wrong with this family in general, which is that they're a family of real over-communicators. You know, it's a family in which no hurt or slight can be left untouched or unaddressed, and in which nothing is out of bounds for discussion, no matter how uncomfortable it makes their children or each other. There's a great scene when the moms get convinced that their son is gay, and so they try and have a sit down with him about it, and he may or may not be gay, but he certainly doesn't want to talk about it right now. But they push onwards and through, and everything is like that in this family. And so when one secret starts being held, I mean, the huge secret of Jules and Paul's relationship, Watching the effects that it has on this family is pretty amazing, and it's pretty amazingly handled on a scene-to-scene basis by Lisa Cholodenko.
Right, and that style that you talk about, that kind of touchy-feely L.A. relationship style that this family mm-hmm. has, is satirized by the movie in a great way. Like, it's really rare and really great to come across a movie that does gentle social satire, that does effective social satire that's not cruel toward the characters. And
right.
I can't think
it's
of
not...
very many directors that do it. It's like Richard Linklater can do it, and Eric Rohmer could do it, you know, and once in a while... I'm trying to think who else will be able to pull it off. Whit Stillman could do it, and Lisa
right.
Cholodenko can do it. She manages to capture this whole kind of absurd world of these affluent, in touch with their feelings, sort of organic food LA types who are nonetheless extremely unhappy and not very good at relating to one another, and to sort of satirize them while being very loving toward them. And it's just a terrific trick to pull off.
Right. She doesn't make you hate them. And these could be in the hands of a much meaner director, or really even a slightly meaner director, these characters could be really hateful.
But I predict something? I actually predict that there's going to be a backlash against this movie. It's opening today. It's had a huge wave of critical love. I think it's something like 98% on Rotten Tomatoes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually because of the social class question, not even so much because of the alternative family structure, but because of the bougie nature of the world, the world that it paints this portrait of, that there's going to be a snarky backlash against it in the next couple of weeks. The way there was against Sideways, it actually kind of reminds me of Sideways in some ways, which I love. I think Sideways is a terrific movie. And I remember mm-hmm. that a few weeks after the wave of love for Sideways, there were all these people saying, why should we care about these, affluent Californians and their tour of the wine country. Essentially, basically, these people's problems aren't interesting because they have too much money. And I can see there being some sort of snark like that about this movie. Do you see that happening?
I definitely see it happening, but it's interesting that you would compare it Sideways, because I would place Lisa Cholodenko and Alexander Payne at almost exact opposite ends of the empathy spectrum for their characters. There's never been an Alexander Payne movie where I felt like he had nearly the level of affection for his characters that Lisa Cholodenko obviously
has. He's a meaner satirist, I think, but I do see a gentle edge to his social satire, especially in Sideways. I think that's one of his least cruel movies. You're right that he's got a little bit more of a knife's edge than Lisa mm-hmm. Cholodenko, but he's not like a Coen brother or somebody who's just like
yes.
waiting in the wings to come out and stab you.
That's true, and I agree with you that I think that there will be some level of backlash against this movie, but I think that it might be minimal only because this movie is so really unbelievably lovable. And it's hard for me to imagine people walking out of this movie, at least not in the beginning, feeling real affection for these characters, no matter what their, bougie social status is, and no matter how organic their garden is, and no matter how, earthy and sexy Mark Ruffalo is. I feel like there's so much affection in this movie for these characters that it has to transport most viewers, right? Won't most people walk out of this movie feeling like they love these guys?
But maybe some people don't want to feel that love. All I can say is that when I read my first snarky backlash review and or blog post about this, I'm going to be emailing you triumphantly
right.
about it. I had
right,
one,
right.
as long as we're spoiling and talking about the movie's love for its characters, I wanted to talk about the fate of the Mark Ruffalo character, the last time we see him, and the implication. I mean, just to do some of that ridiculous supposition about what would happen if the movie continued after the movie was over.
Sure.
Do you think that... Okay, well, so the last time we see Mark Ruffalo, he's basically been shut out of the family, right, when the affair is discovered. Nick is completely furious. She bars him from the kids' lives, and the kids actually are furious, too, and bar him from their own lives. And there's a moment that they're all – the nuclear family is sitting having dinner, sort of starting to patch up this horrible thing that's ripped their lives open, and he appears at the door.
It's on the last night before
– Oh, right.
Before
the eve of her
going to college. Right. And so it's like their last family dinner. And there's there's tension in the air, but there is peace sort of at last. And into this peaceful last dinner comes Mark Ruffalo, comes Paul, trying to make things right. Fairly honestly, you certainly seem to make things right. He feels terrible about what he's done. He really has surprised himself with how much his relationship with Joni and Laser, the two kids, has meant to him. And so he's trying to make amends, but at the same time, he's making amends really at the absolute worst possible moment he could. It's much too soon. It's Joni's last night at home. No one's ready for him to be there. And so he shows up on the front porch, and I think it's Joni answers the door, right?
Yeah, she's the first one too.
Right. And he stammers out a few apologies, and she gives him the cold shoulder, and Nick and Jules send him away. And so the last we see of him is through the window, right? Just sort of looking sadly in at the family.
Right. And the last thing that Nick, Annette Bening's character, says to him is really cold. She just says something about get your own fucking family or something and basically slams the door in his face. And the last we see of him is, you know, just looking like a sad little fluffy Ruffalo puppy standing on the steps. Mm-hmm. And I really felt for him at that moment. And I just couldn't decide to what extent the movie agreed with Nick and thought, you know, this guy really needs to stay the hell away. And there's a little bit of a tentative possibility in the young girl and Joni's interaction with him that they might see each other. He says, well, can I ever be part of your life again? She says, I don't know. And it's sort of left hanging there. And at the end of the movie, I mean, we can also spoil what happens at the very end of the movie, but I couldn't help but wish that Mark Ruffalo in The Kids Are All Right Too would get to come back and be some part of the kids' lives. Because for all of his fucking up, he did seem like kind of a great character and kind of a cool sperm donor dad to have.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and The Kids Are All Right Too, the college years, I imagine he heads over to Stanford and does become part of Joni's life again. I've viewed the movie as, I mean, part of what the movie is about, at least that last act of the movie, is people finding ways to forgive each other for unforgivable things, right? And so, I mean, the movie ends with certainly a level of rapprochement and peace between Jules and Nick, as they drop Joni off at college, and
a scene. May I point out the second movie this summer to make me cry in a scene in which a kid is leaving for college after Toy Story 3.
Guy, and you've got what, like 12 years to go before that actually happens.
Yeah, you're right. Oh, I'm gonna be practicing.
You got a lot of crying ahead of you, Dana.
Yeah, but there's a really wonderful single shot where both the moms hug the daughter at the same time. And we kind of know that everything that's gone into this moment and what a hard last few months they've had. But that moment really transcends the story of this movie. It's sort of just any two parents saying goodbye to their kid as they go away for the first time to begin their adult life. And I was just overwhelmed. I thought it was just so crushing.
Right. To me, the overarching, almost, I mean, the emotional aesthetic of this movie is one of forgiveness for the unforgivable. And so to my mind, this is certainly not the last time that Paul is going to be in their lives. And I think that the idea I got was that there was a messy future ahead of them, but that he was part of that future.
Right.
Is that Nick would gently ease the pedal off her anger, and the kids would ease the pedal off theirs, and that as hard as it may be, they would find a way to include him because I think in the end they all see that for all his fuck-ups, he's as nice a guy as they are. You know, he's no more fucked up than Jules is, and they're fucked up in similar ways, and that there's a place for him in their lives. And, you know, it's interesting, what you mentioned about that last scene and how it sort of transcends the movie and how it could be any two parents reminds me that, I mean, through this whole entire conversation, we've made no really specific references at all to the fact that it's a lesbian couple raising these kids. And so the universality of this story is commendable and interesting, but do you think that people will get on this movie simply for it not being political enough, for it not taking a stand really in any way, or do you view that as one of the movie's strengths?
I don't know. I'm curious to see which way that goes. And it is true. It is odd that we have barely mentioned the fact that it's two women bringing up kids. I mean, I think that is, for me, an argument in favor of the movie and that it's not a social issues movie. I think it's a movie that you walk out of thinking about these characters and this family and not, gee, what does it mean to be a donor child or to be brought up by two moms? Although that does come up explicitly at several points in the movie. And at one point, Joni, when she's drunk and angry at her moms, accuses them of trying to bring her up as the perfect overachieving, you know, trophy child so that they can prove that gay parenting works or something like that.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, I think that if you did grow up in an alternative structured family, you might be extra involved and extra interested in this movie. But I think people who think that they don't want to go to it because they're not interested in a preachy movie about alternative families should really go ahead and buy their ticket.
Right, because there's zero preaching in this movie. I mean, other than
In fact, I think the people that might be most offended by it, and maybe this is what you were pointing at a second ago, might be, you know, activist gay families who feel like, wait a minute, we want a positive portrait to be drawn. You know, this isn't such a positive portrait of a family, gay or otherwise. It's, as you say, a pretty messed up family. It's also not particularly preachy in terms of, you know, homosexual relationships, because there's a heterosexual relationship in the middle of it, right? I mean, people might be upset by the fact that this woman has an affair with a straight guy.
Right. Well, as with all of Lisa Cholodenko's movies, this is a movie that, it, among other things, is about the fluidity of desire and about how people are attracted to the people they are attracted to, not necessarily to men or women all at once or all to the exception of the other.
That's true. All her movies do have that in common. I think this is the best of her movies by far, if only for the simple reason that everybody, every actor in this movie is really good. And I think both of her first two movies have a weak spot in a major character who's played by an uninteresting actor, Radha Mitchell in the first one and Kate Beckinsale in the second. But that's a whole other spoiler.
Right, right. And, you know, we were talking about this a little before we started recording that, I mean, one thing that Lisa Chalanenko does really well and that we haven't really touched on at all in this discussion is sex scenes. And I noticed in this movie, and I mean, the sex scenes are extremely sexy in this movie. I think Julianne Moore is incapable of being unsexy, as is probably Mark Ruffalo. But the scenes are also played for comedy in a lot of ways. I mean, they have smash cuts for the purposes of comedy. Julianne Moore is extremely uninhibited, in her comedic physicality in those sex scenes, which to me is like sort of the way you can tell that Lisa Chalanenko has made like a straight comedy. Aside from a happy ending or the jokes or whatever, you know it because her sex scenes are funny instead of like super serious the way
you're
they
right.
have
And the movie actually opens on a funny sex scene between the two women, which is just basically a sort of parody of married sex where neither of the two people can really get into it because they've had sex too many times.
Right.
So they're watching this male gay porn movie to try to get into it and their kids over here. It's just this kind of ridiculous sex farce scene that opens the movie that kind of loosens up the viewer from step one.
Right. So overall, yes, I agree with you. This is Lisa Chalanenko's best movie. I mean, I also think it's one of the best movies of the year so far. I mean, it's extremely funny and heartfelt. And though obviously this is a fucked up family, they're an extremely recognizably fucked up family and one that at the end I felt really a great deal of affection for. And I guess in a way, I mean, for those looking for those who are worried that this movie does not make enough of a statement, I mean, obviously – making a movie about a totally dysfunctional yet totally lovable and in the end totally recognizable gay family is still in these days in Hollywood is still a bit of a political statement. And I mean, from that standpoint, the movie certainly is not apolitical. It just isn't preachy in a way that I think people might be worried about.
All right. Well, Dan, it's nice to have a rave, right? It's nice to spoil a movie that we both just pretty much unreservedly loved for a change.
I know.
Right?
I know.
I guess we did have Toy Story 3 recently, so we've had a couple this summer.
It's been a pretty good summer for a movie. I mean, it hasn't been a good summer for summer movies, but it's been a good summer for almost everything else. I mean, this is the third movie this summer that I pretty unreservedly loved, and it's nice to have that in the otherwise overheated months of blockbusters.
Wait, just quickly, what was the one besides Toy Story 3 in this one?
Winter's Bone.
Oh, Winter's Bone. All right. That's another whole conversation.
That is. We'll get into that at the end of the year.
Okay, Dan. Thanks a lot for joining me for this late spoiler special.
My pleasure.
Our producer is Krishnan Vasudevan. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.